You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's returned for an eighth season. We're back as we look to explore those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith, and joining me as co-host for this episode and the next 17, it's...
me, Matt Michael.
Woohoo!
And woo! Yeah, you join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audio, short stories. Actually, we may need to revise this bit over the course of the season, as everything is about the printed page.
It certainly is, especially printed pages that smell cheap.
Cheap paper.
But we'll come back to that later.
As a bouquet.
Do you know what I've noticed recently when I've been digging my old books, like my new adventures and stuff that have been in storage in the loft and properly contained plastic boxes, just the smell of the books, and it's something I keep doing when I'm reading them.
It's just like a book sniffer.
Yeah.
I've heard about men like you.
Yeah, we go around, we nick books from ladies' shelves. Quite. Anyway, our eighth season is all about the Eighth Doctor adventure novels, which were published by BBC Books in the 1990s and early 2000s. However, unlike our fifth season, when we covered the first 18 novels in the series, we won't be bringing you an episode a day this time, because that would just be complete and utter madness.
It would be bonkers, wouldn't it?
It would. It would just be a little bit too much, but there we go. So we're back. So Matt, thank you for joining us for the season, and Becca will hopefully be back in season 9. Whatever that may contain, who knows?
Ooh, indeed. Who knows? I'm tapping my nose like...
yes, Tom Baker style.
Curating. Yes.
Yes, which is good. So have you been keeping busy since last season and having lots of Eighth Doctor fun and listening to his audios and things like that?
I have been keeping busy, and I've been really enjoying Charlie's fantastic return with Audacity. Been enjoying Charlie and Kerry's return with the Sontarans.
Oh, yes.
Charlie's return with the Sixth Doctor. It feels like 2004 all over again at the moment. Brilliant.
Yeah, could nick that. What was the big thing slogan? Like, it's like Saturday tea time in 1977.
It's like the Galaxy 4 shop in 2004 all over again.
Who's queuing up to get their CD signed by Conrad and Eddie Robson and whoever else it may be that's there to do the signing? So
it's brilliant. It's amazing to think that Big Finish has now got the longevity that it can do its own sort of bringing back the Brigadier or bringing back, you know, the First Doctor or whatever it's doing. It's doing its own bringing back now.
Yeah.
It's got such a hinterland to it. It's amazing.
Yeah. And of course, bringing back Kerry's.
And Kerry's, yes.
We do love Kerry's on this podcast.
We do.
Especially Conrad.
We do. It's man of many colours, some of them his own.
They were red and yellow and pink. No, we'll stop there. We're not going to go there. No, we're going to be talking about another companion, especially today, with the arrival of Fitz Kreiner. Mm. But we're going to be talking about the Taint, or technically, as you pointed out to me in an email a few weeks ago, we should be calling it Doctor Who and the Taint every single time. You better explain why.
So, obviously, the cover says Doctor Who the Taint with a sort of electric skull with its brain exposed. But you open the book, as I have just done, and it says Doctor Who and the Taint by Michael Collier. And I believe the way that libraries work, that it's actually the title page that provides the sort of official catalogue title for the book, not the cover. So as the inside page says Doctor Who and the Taint, that is, in fact, what it's officially known as.
Well, there we go. For the rest of this podcast, we should be calling it Doctor Who and the Taint.
I strongly approve of that, being okay. A target reader myself.
Yeah, that works. Okay, so let's find out a little bit about this book. As Doctor Who and the Taint, I can hear our American listeners giggling now every time we see the word taint. If you've ever heard the episode of the Doctor Who Book Club where they discuss this episode, every time they say the taint, somebody's giggling away. So there we go. Anyway, Doctor Who and the Taint was the 19th novel in the BBC Eighth Doctor Adventure series. It was written by Michael Collier and released on the 1st of February 1999, featuring the Eighth Doctor and Sam Jones, as well as introducing new companion Fitz Kreiner. But before we go any further, Matt, would you mind telling us what the back cover blurb has to say about it?
Certainly can. I have it in my hands as I speak. It's a beautiful black cover. It's very striking, actually. The Eighth Doctor books usually had sort of a bluish, reddish kind of cover or something like that. But for the special releases, they always seem to like to either go for plain white or plain black, and they really sort of pop. Anyway, the back cover. The TARDIS has finally brought the Doctor and Sam back to Earth and straight into danger. It is 1963. Six very different people have been gathered together for study by parapsychologist Charles Rowley in his stately home outside London. All of them claim to have been possessed by the devil, and all have shared similar delusions. They describe the same bizarre death cave, riddled with demons. Rowley's experiments are having a gradual yet terrifying effect on his subjects, and the Doctor and Sam discover the connections between those tainted with the madness are more disturbing than anyone could guess. For the Doctor, too, has seen the cave they describe on a dead world billions of years ago. Introducing the Eighth Doctor's new companion, Fitz Kreiner, this book is another original adventure for Doctor Who.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Matt. That was very good, particularly the billions of years ago. I did like the dramatic very flourish awesome. In which you finished.
I love
very good.
The blurbs of those books.
So, new companions. As a rule, how do you find their first stories interesting?
I think it's generally really good. It's even in the TV series, it's often a chance to sort of soft relaunch the show. And when it's done well, I think it has a... It's a real jumping on point for people. So I'm thinking things like maybe the Time Meddler. It's a great jumping on point. It really sort of fills Stephen in on the background of how the TARDIS works. And it's a really nice introduction. The Time Warrior is a fantastic introduction for Sarah Jane. And it sort of explains the premise of the series. And you can kind of get back into the series through the new character's eyes and experience a bit of the thrill of Doctor Who through a brand new person going into the TARDIS for the first time, saying, oh, it's bigger on the inside, all of that stuff. And I think that's the kind of vibe that Doctor Who and the Taint is going for. I think Sam, I didn't have huge problems with Sam, but I don't think the consensus was that she'd worked out quite as well as people had hoped, despite the best efforts to sort of age her up in Seeing Eye. And I think Fitz and the Taint offer a kind of relaunch for the series. And I think it's really interesting, for example, it goes back to 1963. So obviously it's not Coal Hill, but it's going right back to the beginning. And that's kind of what Moffat did, for example, with the 50th anniversary, going back to sort of Coal Hill. It's a real good opportunity to sort of go back to the series roots and start again.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a soft reboot. I mean, you think of like Smith and Jones. I think it's just such a great introduction for Martha. Completely different dynamic with the Doctor. And there's just a completely different energy. And again, you get the same partners in crime going back. Even stuff like Robot, we get a new Doctor and a new companion in Harry, who we instantly all fall in love with. And... yeah, it's just that change in dynamic, the change in energy, the Time Warrior being another one where the Doctor's clashing with Sarah a bit to start with, which you wouldn't have him doing with Joe, with that established dynamic. And I think that they just change it because it brings out more of the Doctor. You get to see, you know, how they relate to other people, because obviously with using Martha again as an example, that he's completely oblivious to the fact that she's absolutely head over heels for him. And yeah. I think it's a wonderful dynamic that he doesn't see that. And he's not being intentionally cruel to her, you know, taking, you know, as they go into places he's been with Rose. And yeah, I really enjoy it. And I think that with this book, we do get that dynamic needing, I mean, it had needed a mix-up without a doubt.
Yeah.
And it introduced a character who pretty much was there for the rest of the Eighth Doctor's run.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
little...
well, they jumped into a volcano at the end, yeah.
Yeah, which I need to ask Lance what happened next one day. One day, but I need to get hold of him first.
It's the end. That was the end of the series.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything else is just a cheese dream.
Yeah. John Hurt. Who? Eccleston? Nah. Tennant? It's apart from Capaldi. Capaldi's allowed. Sorry, I'm slightly biased there, but there we go. Anyway, something that I've managed to do, which has never been published before or read aloud, is the original character outline for Fitz. And I was able to get a hold of that. And interestingly, it's headed the Eighth Doctor's new companion, Fitz Kreiner. But the spelling of Kreiner has got the I and the E transposed throughout it. So there we go. Just something that...
Kreiner.
Yeah.
Because the Germans, I think, put the second letter is what sort of dictates the pronunciation. So I think Fitz Kreiner doesn't quite have the ring to it. I think they were going for Kreiner the crooner.
He wishes with his badly played guitar. But yeah. So Matt, would you care to tell us what this document has to say?
I'd love to. It's really, really interesting. I was fascinated to read this when you shared it. So Fitz Kreiner was born in Windsor on the 7th of March 1936, as Hitler reclaimed the Rhineland for Germany. His father was German, a patriot, but also a liberal who fled his homeland in disgust when the Nazis came to power. Despite his opposition to Hitler and everything he stood for, he and his family found themselves victimised because of their nationality by their English neighbours, both during and for quite a long time after the war. Fitz himself inherited his father's idealism, becoming instead defensively cynical at quite a young age. As far as he's concerned, there's no point in sticking to principles. His father did and paid for it with a lifetime of ostracism and an early embittered death. Fitz himself, picked upon and excluded throughout his school years, has become a loner with few friends, retreating further and further into a fantasy world of his own. It's one that in 1963, when the Doctor and Sam first meet him, he's still not all that keen on leaving, which is one of the contributing factors to his joining the TARDIS crew, a new fantasy to escape into from the boredom of his life on Earth. He is a tall and gangly figure. His hair is dark brown, thick and straggly. His face is thin and he shaves only occasionally, taking little care over his appearance. His nose is sharply pointed, eyes grey and wide. There is a quiet intensity about him for all his attempts to be the personification of ennui, which both sexes find attractive.
That's interesting. That's something that wasn't often picked up upon.
No, I think it amused me when I read this, because it does sound like it's describing pretty much the average Eighth Doctor reader in 1999, to be honest.
Yep.
I sort of read it, you know, a grown up, but sort of clinging to their old fantasies, and a bit unkempt. And I'm thinking, I'm sure I met more than one person who fit this description at the tavern in about 1998.
Yeah, well, you know what they say, Matt, if the cap fits. Anyway, readers of Doctor Who magazine first heard that Fitz was on the way in issue 266, dated July 1998, some 6 months before he first appeared. The news article appeared in the same issue. That's when it was revealed that Paul McGann would be recording what turned out to be the Earth and Beyond audios under a subheadline of Unpredictable Actor Returns in New Short Stories.
How rude!
That's so rude. Anyway, back to the new companion. And the headline read, Rogue Male Fitz into the TARDIS. That's what they did there. Yeah, but the text told us that a new male character will join BBC Books' regular TARDIS crew of the Eighth Doctor and Sam in January 1999's novel, The Taint, Doctor Who and the Taint. Our Fitz Kreiner, as it is here, a denizen of 1963 Earth, is described as Blake Seven's Villa Restel crossed with Gerald Harper's Adam Adamant, with a bit of Robert Carlyle thrown in. A slightly eccentric, roguish dreamer in his late 20s, with pretensions to being a jazz guitarist, Fitz has been created by BBC Books editor Stephen Cole in association with former Virgin New Adventure Supremo Rebecca Levine and Longest Day author Michael Collier, who penned Fitz's debut adventure, A Pseudo-Demonic Possession Tale. And the piece was accompanied by a picture of Michael Keating as Villa from Series D of Blake Seven.
I can't imagine anything more DWM in 1998 than Blake Seven's Villa Restyle cross with Gerald Harper's Adam Adamant with a bit of Robert Carlyle thrown in. References like decades out of their time for anyone except the very committed Doctor Who fan.
Exactly. Who will understand exactly what that means. Yeah. Particularly, well, depends if they're up to date and watch films like Trainspotting, even though Trainspotting would have been 4 years old by that point.
That's cutting edge for the Wilderness Years Doctor Who fan.
That is true. Yeah, considering they're probably still watching Casualty repeats from 1989 and, in fact, probably 1985 and or 86, bemoaning Lisa Bowerman's untimely departure, but there we go.
Was Robert Carlyle... No, he wasn't Hamish Macbeth, was he?
He was Hamish Macbeth.
He was. I'm thinking someone said, ooh, they should make him the new Doctor Who because he would have been on TV around that time, and that's the only reason why readers of DWM in 1999 would have a clue who he was. Because, like, the Daily Mirror would have, on a quiet day, would have run a story about, could Hamish Macbeth be Dr. Okai the New or something like that?
Don't do that. Don't do the accent. You should be better than
I was in character as the Daily Mirror there, I guess.
Oh, okay. All right, then. We'll let you off, only because you're being the Daily Mirror, but not Matt Michael doing an impersonation of a Scots accent. But no, I think from that, it did intrigue me to think, okay, what's this guy going to be like? Because, as we would later discover, Fitz was pretty much us, the Doctor Who fan, who was sort of perhaps sometimes socially awkward, lacked that little bit of life experience and just had the, if only I could do this, if only I could do that. And I mean, I'd love to be able to play the guitar. I can play the piano quite badly, and I can play the clarinet even worse, and the saxophone, but I'm a pretty damn good whiz on the recorder, not because of Patrick Troughton, because I was made to play it at school. Just to stop stroking your chin, Matt Michael. I think there's straight away.
You've been trying to play this.
No. I take it then that sort of intrigued you as well then at the time.
Do you know what? I don't remember reading. I would definitely have been one of the people reading at DWM and getting those references at the time. So I definitely include myself in the Doctor Who fangene people from 1998. I was aware that Fitz was on the way. I can't remember thinking much about him until actually reading The Taint when he was in front of us. But there was definitely sort of buzz. I used to go down to London every month when I was living in Leeds to the Fitzroy Tavern. I suspect that the Fitzroy Tavern might have played a part in why he's called Fitz. But... because that's where a lot of the Doctor Who authors used to sort of go and meet up on the first Thursday of the month. So there would definitely have been sort of chat about what was coming, and that the books were still in sort of 98, 99, the books and Doctor Who magazine were the main focus for, you know, anything new in the world of Doctor Who. I don't know how much buzz there was around Fitz until he was there, and then he was evidently much more useful as a companion than Sam had been, and immediately kind of, I think, lifted the books and gave them a bit of the sort of character that some people maybe felt they'd been missing over the sort of first 18 months of their run.
That's a good point about Fitz's name. Do you know what? I haven't even thought of that before. I'm going to ask Steve Cole. So by the time we come back to to do demontage, have the answer to find out if that was an influence. So there we go.
They'd probably say no.
It probably would just be no, total coincidence. So I should text them actually and ask them, but no, we'll keep it for next time. So there we go. You can come back, listeners. There's a reason to come back for episode 8.2. Anyway, that's interesting. That's a very good point.
Occasionally, mate. What did you kind of feel? Do you remember getting excited at the idea of
it? I think so. I think it needed a shake up by that point, because yeah. I think that is quite a prolonged period, particularly in print, when you haven't got the visual reference to what the companion's like in their interactions. Mm-hmm. And again, well, we may have liked Sam, it was quite hard to love her. And it was, again, the relatability factor. It's quite hard for us, as you know, we were in our 20s, to relate with somebody who was like a teenage girl or early 20s. And the fact that she's mainly being written by people of our age or a bit older as well. Yeah. And I think there was that, I don't want to say artificial, because that's not quite accurate, but there was something that didn't quite, without that actress input, you know, to get a feel, because you can read books that, you know, you can straight away, Freema Agyeman's voice comes off the page of reading a 10th Doctor novel with Martha or the likes, whereas I think that was something that Sam lacked, but very quickly, once we got these books, Fitz had a voice.
And I think you're absolutely spot on, because I think the first 18 months of the 8th Doctor novels, I think there was a Doctor who'd had about an hour's screen time. So there was a lot less reference material than Sylvester McCoy when they were writing the New Adventures. And obviously, New Adventures had Ace. Well, everyone had seen Sophie Aldred in action on TV. And then Bernice, who had, I think, a relatively well-defined sort of character. Although I think even then it took a while to sort of settle on Benny's sort of personality. I think those early books, she's a bit up and down, sometimes fades into the background a little bit when Ace comes back in her Space Marine costume, which we've all seen the photos of.
Oh, yes.
Some of us more than others, clearly. And then you had Chris and Roz, who were vivid because of the jobs that they did, I think, as much as who they were, although I really liked Chris and Roz as well. And against all of that, I think you've got Sam, who sort of just is there and sort of turns up a bit like Mel in The Trial of a Time Lord. And it's really hard after a slightly dodgy beginning and then character, no one quite settling on what the character was. And as you say, no visual or performance reference material. I think I just don't think anyone had really a good idea of who Sam was or what she sounded like or what she looked like, or who she was. And I think Fitz, you kind of looked around the other Doctor Who fans at the tavern and you're like, oh yeah, I know who Fitz is.
Yeah, very much so. He's obviously looked around. There we go. That's who the companion is, because people will get that character very quickly. Yeah. And yeah, excellent. So Matt, tell me, what have we got next coming up?
Yeah, well, when we ever cover a novel, we create some new readings from the book for you to hear. So in today's episode, Craig Brawley will be reading three extracts from Doctor Who in the Taint. And here's the first meeting between the Doctor and Fitz.
The woman took the proffered parcel with a confused smile and waddled off along the leafy path in the direction of the tea rooms.
"Bibble," sighed Fitz lazily, watching her go. "They are so stupid."
"That's a gross generalisation, surely," came a polite, quiet voice that somehow made Fitz spin round, as if he'd been given an order. "I'd like this begonia, please." The man was looking at him. There seemed something slightly aloof about his manner, about his whole bearing, a sense of detachment from the quiet and the greenery about them. Only the eyes seemed definite, anchored onto his own as if peering inside him. "This begonia?" Fitz broke eye contact and studied the plant. "But it's nearly dead." The man smiled, and Fitz wondered, looking at the stranger's strange clothes and shoulder-length hair, if this man was some kind of dropout himself. "I know," said the man. "I intend to rescue it."
"Rescue it?"
"Indeed, you could call it a calling." Fitz regarded him with his long-practiced look of studied boredom.
"A calling?"
"Oh, you just did. Do you simply like my turn of phrase, or were you raised by parrots?" Fitz realised with a surge of annoyance that his own act was being turned back on him.
1 in 6 for the begonia, he muttered with a puff of cigarette smoke.
1 and 6, sighed the stranger. The price of compassion. The man's face crumpled into a sorrowful frown as he checked the pockets of his dark green velvet jacket. I don't have 1 and 6. Would 2 pence suffice?
Can't do that,
said Fitz vaguely, the hint of a Jobsworth smile on his lips, and glancing about to see if anyone else was in sight. He noticed some old women strolling towards his stall and found himself looking forward to the boredom of their presence.
Oh, please,
begged the strange man, looking longingly at the begonia.
1 in 6 or it goes back.
But I only want to help it. The man broke off and stared at him, suddenly baffled. Why are you putting on that French accent? Fitz felt his face redden as the old women approached closer. He affected anger as the cause for this rush of his dubiously Gallic blood.
How dare you!
On peut apprendre d'un grand homme même lorsqu'il se tait,
said the stranger suddenly, before looking at him expectantly. Fitz realised he was expected to reply. Or had that been gibberish? He opened his mouth mechanically a couple of times as he thought desperately how to regain control of the situation. Finally, he straightened up, stubbed out the cigarette, smiled at the old ladies now queuing patiently behind this loony, and with accent and dignity only barely intact, glared at the man with the infuriatingly bright smile.
All right, Fitz held out his hand. 2 pence.
Straight from the Garden Centre. Thank you very much, Craig, and we'll be hearing more from him shortly. So, let's now hear from the man credited with writing Doctor Who and the Taint. Let's meet Michael Collier.
Hello, my name's Mike Collier. I am a novelist, but I didn't write The Taint, nor did I write The Longest Day. Thank you.
So there we go. That was possibly our most in-depth interview yet on Pieces of Eighth.
I'm shocked. You'd be telling me Nathalie Dallaire didn't write Things Next.
Just you wait till later in the season and you will find out exactly who Nathalie Dallaire is, because Nathalie Dallaire is a real person and I know exactly who they are, but you will find out when we get to Parallel 59. I can see the shocked look in your face. You did not expect that.
Call me Robin Bland.
But yes, Steve Cole was at it again. He wrote the book.
A man of many talents. And names.
Yeah, I'll have to get Tara Sams on sometime, actually.
Hi, I'm Steve Cole. I was the editor of the BBC Doctor Who books in the late 1990s and author of The Taint.
There we go. We know it's out there. You've admitted previously that Michael Collier is you, sort of.
That's right. It's always involved in discussions, but honestly, I'd say, do you mind if your name is put forward once more? And it was actually a dream Mike had had in very vivid detail that kind of turned up in the start of The Taint. That was almost like the starting point of part of the story. So it felt, I said to him, I want to use this in the book. Do you mind if Michael Collier writes again? He was all right with that. Obviously, The Taint was important because it introduced Fitz, and I really wanted to write his first story. I'd spent a long time trying to rework Sam into something that people would enjoy writing for, but it always felt like there was... She was a flawed character in some ways, and the other authors wanted to do different things with her. So I wanted to have a much more clearly defined character who would then almost carry themselves through the books to come, which was why I put a lot of work into coming up with Fitz.
I have to ask, Steve, he's a wannabe musician. He loves James Bond. He likes the ladies. He enjoys a drink. How much of you went into the creation of Fitz Kreiner?
Well, yes, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because my conclusion after doing some work with Rebecca Levine, kicking around different ideas for who Fitz might have been, Rebecca thought that it would be cool to have him as perhaps a black soldier in World War II. He would join the crew. And I felt, yes, that was a nice idea, but it would always mean that at the time, most of the people writing Doctor Who were white, and outside of that area, felt like we'd always be trying to intuit or infer, or, you know, it felt like it would be difficult to get a regular character. I wanted him to be a character who was kind of like Sarah Jane, not a high concept character, someone who would be, you know, readily recognizable every time they went into a situation, because they are themselves. They're not something, they're someone. I thought it would be quite fun to have him start off in 1963, obviously to fit in with the Doctor, the program itself. And yeah, inevitably, I think you kind of think, well, if I was wanting to read these books, what character would I like to see regularly in them? And yes, there are definitely elements of Fitz that are myself. What was interesting was that almost every author I spoke to afterwards was saying, oh, you based Fitz on me. So it seemed to be a character that everyone recognized part of themselves in, and I think the readers did as well, and that helped make Fitz, you know, a pretty popular companion. I think it was just good to have a companion that was different to what had gone before. He shook things up a bit. A male companion to obviously play off Sam, someone who would, like, you know, stir up this quite cozy little duo the Doctor and Sam had become. And, you know, he did just that. And I was pleased that the other authors, you know, picked up on aspects of him that were in the initial character guide and ran with it. Sometimes I felt we did too many changes to him too soon. He goes through an awful lot in that opening run of stories before sort of settling down. But I think that's, you know, that's the nature of authors in a sci-fi franchise. You have your regulars and you want to do exciting new things with them. I'd like to have given him a few more stories before Revolution Man came in, for example, and took him away from the TARDIS for 2 years and sort of brainwashed him, because I felt we were still getting to know him as he was. But equally, it's such a good story, and it worked within it. So, yeah, this is an interesting time for the BBC books, because everything gets a little bit more connected. Fitz is like a catalyst for these stories drawing off in a different direction. I think having the Doctor with two companions helped make these stories richer, and yeah, and just that the thread running through them pulls ever tighter until by the time we reach Interference and the cycle of books that follows up to Shadows of Avalon, there's, yeah, definitely a much tighter arc running, which I said right from the beginning I wouldn't do. I was determined that the BBC books would be less arc heavy and that casual readers could pick them up and get into them. But then you realise that when you are trying to plot out an ongoing run of stories, inevitably you have a closer continuity between them, and arcs are what makes it interesting and what the audience can buy into. So you have to sacrifice a certain amount of accessibility in order to deliver more of a editorial punch, I think. So that's the direction we took, and that direction was signposted, I guess, by the Taint and bringing in Fitz.
Something that you did, I noticed, which obviously 21st century Doctor Who does, is we get to meet the new companion's mum, which, you think about it, I think we maybe very briefly met Chris Quedge's parents in his introduction back in Original Sin. And obviously Benny had lost her mum and lost her dad, who we meet briefly. But of all the new companions introduced, this is really the first proper time that we get to meet their family and see them in a different way, just like Russell T would, of course, later do.
Yes, I think it came from a determination to show a companion in their native place, you know, just to get a real strong sense of who they are and where they came from, which we didn't have with Sam, and that had caused all sorts of problems. So I wanted to have Sam dip into his world, like when she comes back to his room and, you know, his rather dubious red light in the ceiling. We were talking about how much of me is in Fitz. I haven't owned a red light bulb that I put in for a certain relaxing times, you know, a slightly more sort of roguish element. And, you know, again, it was like, I think I don't want to suggest that a lot of the readership were living with their mothers, but I knew, for example, some of the authors were. So there was an element of that. Again, I wanted a character that the readership could relate to more readily, plus also giving him, you know, a slightly historical context is helpful for moving forward with him as well.
We've gone to the actual story, and my goodness, you do horrible things to poor Mrs. Kreiner with the introduction of the labs and all the experiments and things that are going on. It really is quite grisly.
Yes. Now, I confess I haven't gone back to check over the tape before speaking, which I probably should have, but I find it always quite difficult to go back to my stuff in those times. But the taint began in my mind as a non-Doctor Who project. I think I was trying to write a radio play called Devil Men, which was about six people who believe they've been possessed by the devil being invited to the house of, you know, a psychologist to share their stories, writing a book, and sinister things happened therein. I never got all that far with Devil Men, but I liked the basic setup, and I thought that if we can involve the companion with the story quite directly, to give it a real emotional weight for him. Well, you know, what's more emotional than your poor unwell mother being kind of like dragged right into the heart of things. So, and I was interested in those characters and, you know, telling their little stories and then having them come together. So it was, yeah, I remember the writing of this one quite fondly. I wrote fairly quickly over a concentrated period of time because I had to take a holiday from work, of course. Not much of a holiday, because you take time off from editing Doctor Who, but to go and write one. But I did want to make it, you know, myself and have the time to do that. So I remember going to my parents' house, they were away, and writing it with breaks to watch Granada Men and Motors, which was showing The Professionals and The Sweeney and things like that at the time. So I had distractions in the form of 60s TV while I was writing a story set, you know, slightly earlier in the 60s. So it was, yeah, it was good fun to do, but yeah, it did get quite grisly and quite dark, as I recall. But it felt like, you know, I wanted to, you know, signpost a way forward, that things was getting serious.
Going back to Fitz again, the fact that he's a florist, or he was working as a florist, and putting on a French accent, which the Doctor just instantly sees past, and think it's setting up that sort of that dynamic that they were going to go on and have.
Yes, there's that fantasist element to Fitz's personality, which the Doctor can see through, but also which I think he quite enjoys. And of course, the Doctor can offer him a life where, you know, it's the ultimate life for the fantasist, because you can live all these different lives and all these different worlds, or you can sort of like touch them for a short space of time before moving on. There's that little sort of like butterfly aspect of that the Doctor has, of settling on one flower and then moving on to the next. And I think Fitz was very much up for that, which is why the two became close. I think that there's certain elements in that. And the Doctor can sort of recognise that Fitz is kind of like almost born to this lifestyle, but Fitz is also terrified of life in many ways as well. And the two can help each other out.
Yeah. And of course, his relationship with Sam, I think it brings something out a bit different in Sam as well. In fact, she's sort of like the fact that Fitz evidently quite likes her. But then again, I think Fitz probably would, anything that is female, he would be quite attracted to. But there's a really fun dynamic between them.
Yes, it was nice to shake up. Yeah, the character of Sam a little and make her a bit edgy. I mean, I seem to recall there's a bit where Fitz tries to suggest that more has passed between them than it actually has, because Sam is blacked out. I don't think I would write that way today. But the idea that he is an unreconstructed fella from the 60s without any of Sam's more enlightened viewpoints was kind of part of what we were to do, and to take him on a sort of journey that would, you know, change him or enlighten him a little. I'm not sure how far we progress with that particular pathway, but when you're setting up a companion, you want to have lots of different avenues to explore, or I think you should do. You want to be able to take them in different directions and hopefully educate them a little as to what's out there and how they can how they can grow themselves. Of course, the relationship between Fitz and Sam is later changed with Dark Sam in Unnatural History. So, you know, we had ideas of where this would go. And so by setting up that, you know, initial attraction, as you say, Fitz is, shall we say, unfussy when it comes to romantic altercations. But obviously, Sam is someone with whom he forms a very real friendship, and it's probably the first proper female friendship he's had. So it was, you know, nice to take them from one point and just sort of like draw them along into a relationship where, you know, they can trust and depend on each other. It doesn't come straight away, as we find over the next few books, but Fitz always has that slight unreliability about him, despite his best intentions, which creates a tension there, I think, between Sam, who will unequivocally do what she thinks is right, and Fitz, who really, really wants to, but actually is also kind of like scared or panics or, you know, gets it wrong, with the Doctor obviously vacillating between these two aspects of the hero in the general run of things. So yeah, I think it was certainly fun to sort of like to chuck Fitz into the books at this point. And for me, it marks the time where I was able to, you know, properly take more control of the books. I felt that I'd been playing catch up since the start, and I'd inherited a lot of other people's formats and characters and ideas of where it could go. And there was a lot of, you know, trying to keep the cart rolling along, keep the wheels on it. So the team was time to say, okay, let's park the cart for a bit, put a few new tires on, and I'm not sure a car has tires on its wheels. That's a terrible analogy, but you get the idea.
No, to rubber rim.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was doing there, the outer rubber rim.
Would you ever have predicted how popular he would have been and the fact that he was there for the rest of the EDAs?
Well, no. I mean, you sort of hope that, you know, a character will have longevity. I was just hoping that, you know, he'd be more popular than Sam had been, that he would give us, I thought he had potential, and I'm glad that he stuck around, because it was really nice for me to come back to the range, you know, later on and be writing Eighth Doctor Adventures and for Fitz still to be there. Right up to the end. So yeah, that was very nice. And of course, getting to write an audio for him for Big Finish was a treat as well. And, you know, more recently, the Eighth Doctor short story in the Target collection. It was nice to go back to Fitz, and whether he was with Sam or Compassion or Angie or Trix, you know, he was kind of the Jamie for the literary Doctor. He was that companion who would, like, you know, just stay by him through thick and thin, no matter what they'd been through.
Yeah,
and there's something, you know, quite admirable about that, and sweet, which I think was part of the character.
And of course, he did get a mention in the novelization of The Day of the Doctor as well, when the Little Knight of the Doctor segment in Chapter 8.
He did, after I asked Stephen if he would mind including Fitz. Because he hadn't made it into the TV version, but I felt as we were in that literary universe, it felt appropriate. And yes, Stephen very kindly added Fitz without fuss or complaint. So that was good.
Yay! That's what we like. It's canon. I'm sure somebody will have redubbed Knights of the Doctor's Hand and all the extra companions that have Big Finish have introduced since, and fine clips with Sam and Fitz, Compassion, because they do all get name checked at some point. Destry, yeah, they'll all be in there somewhere.
Yeah, you'd have to keep cutting away to O'Hela, sort of like, you know, sort of looking like, this is like endless shot of her, but saying, come on, how many more?
As she inspects her fingernails. Bliss.
Yes, right. We've got to get this brew Alex. Working here.
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. Steve, thanks as always.
Pleasure.
Naughty Steve Cole. What a cheeky wag he is, having written Longest Day using his friend's name and then doing it again.
I know. It's what? Shocking.
Oleg, disgraceful behaviour.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a stern letter to Guy Leopold complaining.
Definitely. And David Agnew.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
The woman actually needs to step in as well to sort this.
Yeah, they'll sort this out. But I have to say, Matt, after that intensive interview, Mike emailed me to say that he got paid zero for doing nothing at all on the book. Imagine that, not getting paid for not working. What is the world coming to?
Do you think that's his skull on the cover? Do you think he...
That'd be a bit much, getting sort of, we want to x-ray your brain.
So you can have some,
yeah, just
off
for
the top of an egg.
Cracking idea.
It's no joke.
Well, did you shell out for that joke? It was all white.
All white, like the white albumin.
Oh God. Sorry, have I left your brain feeling scrambled?
Yes, that's quite enough of that.
Okay.
Yes. Shall we have a second extract from the book rather than talking about eggs? What do you think?
I think we should. Over to you, Craig.
Fitz swore. This wasn't right. She shouldn't look like that. Having a go at Bulwell had taken it right out of her. He wanted to go off and find Rowley himself, see what could be done for her, but didn't want to leave his mum alone like this, sweating, wheezing, only half aware. That will do, Mr. Kreiner. Fitz looked up. There in the doorway was Watson, staring at him. What are you on about? Fitz said, then noticed the man's hand. Christ, what have you done to yourself? I'd rather you didn't use his name when you speak to me, Watson said smoothly. Now, stand away from her. That's my mother you're talking about. Is it? Said Watson. No. That's just a hindrance there, isn't it? A millstone round your neck. A pain in the backside, boy. Isn't that what you think of her? Fitz stared at him. So what if I do? He said quietly. She wouldn't be my mother if she wasn't, would she? Watson advanced on him. Fitz swallowed hard, but stood his ground. This woman has lived most of her life in fear, Watson said. Afraid of reprisals for the choices she's made. Afraid of losing you, afraid of losing herself. Fitz could only watch as the man sat next to his mum and held her hand. Immediately, her breathing calmed, her feverish look drained away. It's time others felt that fear, continued Watson. We do, mate, believe me, we do. Fitz held out a hand warily to his mum. Come on, he said, you're coming with me. His mum didn't even look at him. Get out, Fitz, she said. Mum, I just can't get out, she screeched. Fitz backed away involuntarily. The world will be sorry for what it's done to me, she shouted, and so will you. Watson laughed. Seems you're no longer needed, doesn't it? Go on then, boy, run off to Rowley and tell him the news. It'll be the test cases doing the testing from now on. Fitz shook his head as his mum sat bolt upright and started laughing. Satan has me again, lad, she gurgled. He'll parade me through hell, he will. Then she was suddenly contrite, humble. Don't let them put me in care again, Fitzy, will you? She said softly. Mum, I... Get out, she screamed at him. Get out before I kill you. The words came again and again, and he didn't know if they formed a threat or a warning. Tears clouded his vision, and through the blurry haze, she looked like his old mum again. This screaming thing wasn't her. It couldn't be. He knew it. Watson had her under some kind of spell, that was it. Why wasn't the doctor back yet? He had all the answers around here.
And now, because we like you so much, We've got a bonus interview for you with Rebecca Levine, who previously edited the Virgin New Adventures and helped create Fits with Steve.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Levine, former editor of the New and Missing Adventures. I'm also a professional writer these days and still an editor. And I was going to write a book for the BBC, but other work came in and I had to withdraw from it, which was a shame. I was also, because I was friends with Steve Cole, we talked together about the creation of Fits, although it was much more him than me, obviously, because it was his imprint.
Maybe tell us a wee bit about how you got involved with the creation of the character who everybody came to love, Mr. Fitz.
It really was just because Steve and I were mates and we just sort of chatted about it. I was obviously, you know, flattered to be asked to talk. Not that he needed advice particularly. I mean, obviously Steve's extremely good and as has been shown by his subsequent career. But yeah, we talked it over because obviously at that point I had more experience of creating characters for the range than he did. And I think it's just always helpful to have a sounding board. That's most of my writing work from the Virgin Adventures onwards has been in teams. That's what I like doing best, because I think having another brain in the room helps yours work better. And so, yeah, I suspect that's why Steve wanted me. And he was a fun cat. You know, he had the original concept for the character and he was a fun character. So it wasn't a hardship to work on him.
Would you say, as somebody who knows Steve Cole well, that Fitz is in many ways just Steve Cole in time and space?
Well, I haven't been in touch with Steve for a long time. There were certain, I mean, yeah, there were definitely similarities.
Yeah, it's funny because I've got to know Steve quite well in over the last year and a bit, and yeah, there's definitely just little lines that I now hear when I read Fitz. I just hear Steve's voice. But Steve, of course, is far more gentlemanly, we should point out.
Yes.
I know, I think...
an actual criminal.
Definitely not on the run. I mean, did you find that your experience with the likes of, you know, helping develop, you know, Benny through her stages and then Chris and Rose latterly helped feed into Fitz because you knew what sort of the pitfalls and things to avoid?
Yeah, absolutely. It's knowing who will bounce off other characters well, who'll generate drama. I mean, I now have a much better vocabulary for talking about this because I've been working now for 30 years on story. But at the time, I don't think I could have put all of it into words, but I think I hopefully instinctively understood, you know, all the classics of character creation, that they need to want something, that they also need something, and what they want isn't necessarily what they need, and that there have to be obstacles in the way, and that there should be conflict with the other characters, and I mean, very obvious stuff. But yeah, that because we tried out characters who didn't quite work as well, and so yeah, I think I probably knew some landmines not to tread on.
Yeah, I think that's something that is the BBC found quite quickly with the creation of Sam Jones, that she didn't just have quite enough depth to her initially, and Steve did his best to try and add some, but ultimately she was written off and off she went, and Fitz came along, and well, the fact that he virtually lasted the whole run from there on in says a lot about his popularity.
Yeah, I mean ultimately you want it, you're going to be spending a lot of time with these people as a reader or a writer, and you want them to be someone it's fun to spend time with and fun to explore, that they sort of open out in a fractal way, you know, that there's always more depth there and more nuance as you get into them, rather than a closed off character whose conflicts are over, who knows who they are. I mean, I personally find characters, not that I think this is Fitz necessarily, but characters who lack self-knowledge incredibly fun to write, because then there's so much in the subtext, and the subtext is where creative works live and die.
Absolutely. And I think the fact you've got an engaging character who you do want to spend time with, and it was just had such a great journey. Did you follow his journey from start to finish, or drip in and out?
I didn't at all. But as I said, after I'd finished the work, I needed a break. I just needed a break from Doctor Who. I love it. I still love it, you know, but... yeah, my brain needed to think about other things for a while.
She's his mother.
And thanks to all of our interviewees for their time. Now, this book was reviewed in DWM 276 by Vanessa Bishop. Now, Matt, before we do this, would you place any credence on DWM reviews of Doctor Who books? Do you think they're worthwhile?
No, I think they're all rubbish. I clearly, because we're about to hear what Vanessa Bishop had to say about Doctor Who and the Taint, but I didn't start reviewing them for DWM until Father Time, so we're still a good couple of years away from my arrival at Doctor Who magazine, and you know the quality suddenly skyrocketed. I can't even play that with a straight face.
No, good old Ness, togetherness, forgiveness is what you need for that comment. Anyway, let's hear what Ness had to say. You can hear some edited highlights from her review. Despite some clever stylized writing, particularly to denote the patient's own perceptions of their barkingness, the Taint, Doctor in the Taint, spirals uncontrollably towards the glum. Further to this turn, its plot becomes both impenetrable and increasingly static, and when not static, then crushingly repetitive. Dr. Rowley's research tactics appear endless and futile in the face of so little development. Events at this deranged mansion become misty and confused. If a sense of progression was clear in the author's mind, it has drifted badly in its transition to the page. The Taint, Doctor Who and the Taint, is given the task of introducing new companion Fitz Kreiner, a Billy Liar-type fantasy seeker in his late 20s. He harbours aspirations that Collier's harsh portrayal of the 1960s cannot deliver. While he dreams of the lifestyle afforded a mop-top beetle, the author relentlessly plays upon the gritty greyness of his urban existence, nearer to Cathy Come Home than to Carnaby Street. Fitz is constantly living the lives of others as an aspect the writers would be wise to play on. TARDIS travel offers great opportunities for his role-playing and comic potential. Unfortunately, Fitz's attraction for Sam is instant. She, lost to brattish colloquialism, is a drag, so he clearly hasn't fallen for her character. With regret, just when you believe that Doctor Who fiction has finally taken its nose out of the knicker drawer, the author, retreading tired paths, rams it back in again. Fitz's fantasizing, as the next reviewed demontage illustrates, can be put to greater use than imagining Sam in her bran pants. So that's kind of harsh. And I think it's fair to say that Ness wasn't particularly taken with the book. Were you taken with the book, Matt?
I think that's a tough review. Is it always interesting to sort of hear a different perspective on the books? And I think there probably is. Nowadays, we would probably be thinking much more about the kind of sexual politics of them than we might have done in the late 90s, when I'd guess the vast majority of readers were male. And I was reflecting on that final point around, you know, imagining Sam in her bra and pants, and just kind of a bit, I can't remember that specific section, but I think there were a few bits and bobs in the books like that at that time. But overall, I think that's I think I enjoyed the book more than that. I think it has quite a nice horror style, and I'm a big fan of horror in Doctor Who, because I think Terence Dix said it really nicely, that there's the tension between Doctor Who, which is science fiction, coming up against horror, and gothic horror in particular, creates that beautiful alchemy, because you've got two very different genres sort of clashing together and making magic. And I think something of that's in the Taint. It always reminded me a little bit of Image of the Fendal, because it's that sort of big creepy house, things sort of going around the corridors, there's the body horror bit of heads bursting open. So I think I enjoyed it more than Ness Bishop did. I don't think it's the greatest book in the range. I don't think of the books that we're going to be covering in series 8, I don't think it's going to come out as one of the top ones, but I thought it was a good introduction for Fitz. And I think it's partly there to do a job as well, right? It's the reason, I guess, why Steve Cole decided to write it himself is it needs to establish new companion, it needs to establish his background, his relationship with his mother, his relationship with the doctor, his relationship with Sam. It's got a lot of work to do, and probably mindful of what went wrong when Sam was introduced. It's like, it feels right that the range editor would then take on, just like maybe, you know, Robert Holmes or Terence Dix or Eric Saywood would have taken more effort on scripts that are introducing a new regular. It feels like that's the kind of thing that a range editor absolutely should do. So I think I enjoyed it more than Ness, and I think that review, I feel it's a little bit harsher than the book deserves, but you know, everyone's got their own reaction to it.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, for me, it feels like it's a three-act book. You've got the opening as we get to meet Fitz, and there's the build-up. Then there's the middle part when we get to discover what the Beast and the Benelizans are around. And then we get to the denouement with the resolution and Fitz joining the TARDIS team, and the absolute horror of Fitz's mum being killed. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's something that you wouldn't expect. You'd think a nice wee old lady, she's mm-hmm. going to survive, and you know, Fitz will go off on his travels and she'll be okay. But the circumstances into which Fitz is to go into the TARDIS, where he's basically been accused of his own mum's murder, mm-hmm. is, there's a good Scottish word, murder. And it's quite horrific. So, I mean, for me, the opening and final act are definitely the strongest. And I think it slows down a bit in the middle, as I think there's just an awful lot of plot going on, perhaps not with the same amount of action that we have to begin with and at the conclusion. And I think it's like you, I completely agree. I think Ness was very, very harsh on it. And I think it very much serves a purpose. Fitz gets to be showcased. We get to like him pretty much from the word go. The fact that he's using that silly French accent in the garden centre to charm old ladies at the start, and I think that's brilliant. You can just imagine that on TV, sort of somebody with an obviously fake accent and perhaps old ladies falling for it, so he can try and sell some more flowers. But I think I think Ness, on this occasion, you were very, very harsh.
I think the books at that point were not enjoying much critical acclaim in the magazines that still reviewed them, like I guess TV Zone, DWM and DWB and SFX might have been around at that point as well. But I think they were sort of struggling to make an impact, and I think that's a shame. I think some readers were just bitter around the way that the New Adventures licensing issue had resolved itself. And I think that tainted the BBC books a little bit.
Matt Michael and the Taint.
Yes. And I think, you know, I do think people were harsher on them than the New Adventures in general. But, yeah, I quite enjoyed this one. I remember at the time, I bought it at Waterstones. I remember actually buying it at Little Waterstones in Leeds. And I read it pretty much, I think, in a day, and really enjoyed it at that point. So it's not one I've revisited much over the subsequent years until before this podcast, and it probably isn't necessarily one that I would revisit quickly again in the future. Well, I think it does a decent job. And like I said, it's there to kind of serve a purpose. It has to land who Fitz is. And I think on that basis, it's really successful.
Completely agree. I think the fact that we get to get a good grip, I think we know a lot more about Fitz by the end of this story than we do about Sam by the end of...
Yeah.
We'll pick Vampire Science, since obviously the Eight Doctors, it wouldn't be fair to use that as an example. I mean, yes, John and Kate did a great job with what they had to work with, but I think straight away we know a lot more about Fitz. We like Fitz, and we want him to be happy, I think, very quickly. And I think the fact that he's I mean, the fact that, you know, going back to the brand pants comment, that's quite a realistic thing, I think, at that point, because you consider, you know, at this point in the Doctor universe, sex and things were not something that happened. Okay, New Adventures had done it, but you wouldn't have a companion being attracted to another, because you wouldn't obviously wouldn't have had that explicitly stated between the likes of Ben and Polly, or God forbid Ian and Barbara, or even Adric and Nyssa and Tegan, or anything like that at all. But here it's quite blatant that Fitz is very much a bit of a lad. And of course, this being sort of the 90s, when laddish culture and ladette culture as well were at their absolute height, he's very much sort of 90s man in the 60s, or 60s man in the 90s, if you prefer. Pretty much very interchangeable.
The 90s had a huge 60s love in relationship anyway, so I think it's smart to pick a character from the 60s and bring them to the 90s. I think probably by 1999 that was a little bit passe. I think it's probably the earlier 90s that had a real 60s fixation, but it all makes sense, and he's the right companion for the readership at that time. There's no point actively working to alienate your readership. The books didn't have, they weren't broadcasting to millions on BBC One. They had a fairly small regular group of readers, and the last thing you want to do when that's your business model ultimately is to do things that alienate your readers. You want to give them a reason to buy the next book and to enjoy them. I think Fitz is a great example of trying to give your readers more of what they would want to read about.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I think it's a good intro for him. You look at new companion introduction stories on TV, how many of them are ones that you're going to give, you know, like a 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 score to? Not often, because again, I'll harken back to Smith and Jones. It's a good, fun introduction. And okay, you've got your Jadoon on the moon in a platoon. No cell phone, go blowhole. Sorry, I had to do it. I did mention Jadoon. Oh, I have to do it again. No cell phone, go blowhole. And yeah, I think that it's a good beginning, and it certainly sets you off on the right path to want to know, as you say, what happens next.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Oh, I think it works.
Yeah.
And the wrongness, that's what we're saying.
Exactly. Wrongness.
Are you going to sing the theme tune to the Family Nest thing?
Now, there's a thought. I haven't thought of that in a while. There we go. Yes, listeners, go and hop onto YouTube and find out the Family Nest, 1980s British cartoon. Eyewitness. There's a work of genius and wordplay there, but you'll need to find out what I'm talking about by looking in YouTube. So anyway, let's move on, and we'll have a third and final extract from the book, courtesy of our pal Craig Brawley, shall we?
I think we should.
I closed the doors and flicked a few switches on the console, sending the TARDIS on its way. Sam came over and stood next to him. "And now there's a cuckoo in our nest," she said. "Really?" asked the Doctor, his head cocked to one side. "Where?" Sam rolled her eyes. "You know perfectly well what I mean." The Doctor smiled. "You're worried whether our newcomer fits in?" "Stop dodging the issue with crap puns," said Sam. Tentatively, she took his hand. "Things won't be quite the same, will they?" The Doctor's shoulders slumped. "I suppose there will be a longer queue for the bathroom each morning," he said. Sam ignored him and stood on tiptoes, looking into his eyes. "No more just you and me." The Doctor looked at her for some time before the ghost of a smile crept onto his face. His voice was barely more than a breath. "I didn't want to just leave him behind." Sam nodded and took a step back. "It was a mess, wasn't it? All that, and the only other person left alive has his head scrambled," she said. "And he never even carried the poxy leech." "Rowley will be cared for," said the Doctor. "Where there's life, there's always hope." He paused. "Hopes. No matter what the likes of Watson may say." Sam looked at him, searching his eyes for some clue as to how he was really feeling. Fitz's mum screamed for him when she died, she said, finally. The doctor looked down at the console. I know. You told him she never felt a thing. Would it have profited him to have known otherwise? The doctor seemed to be putting the question to a couple of dials, still refusing to look up. Would it have made it any easier for him? It might have comforted him to know that she'd become his mother again before the end. She hadn't, said the doctor, firmly, looking at her now. Her brain was like the others, a balloon filling with water. It could have burst at any moment. I know, she said, softly placing her hand back on his, listening to the whirs and clicks of the TARDIS. I know. She moved away. And you know that sometimes we all have to make decisions, Sam, called the doctor. Sam turned to look at him, standing forlornly by the console. She nodded, smiling faintly, before walking off to her room. I know, she said.
So there we go. Thank you very much, Craig. Poor old Fitz. Knackered, and that's him on the TARDIS. Sam slightly resistant to the idea for some reason.
Mm. Well, maybe she'd read Ness Bishop's review.
Unforgiveness. That's something we should be doing. We should find a something Ness word to go with. Harshness, I think, is the fun to sum up this review. So, yes, we shall do that. But yeah, I think, as we said, decent introduction. It's not going to be a season poll winner in DWM, but it does the job. You've got a mystery, you've got aliens, and you've got a human backstory. You've got a new companion, and off they go to Space Station Vega.
Off they go, and we'll see them there next time.
We will indeed.
And remember, if you've enjoyed this week's Pieces of Eighth, or indeed liked any episode we've done, please do leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from, as it means more people can find our episodes, and it's always appreciated. I'm a Google Podcasts man myself.
Oh, do these podcasts show up in Google? See, I just upload them and then tend to listen to them through my phone and the website.
They do.
Oh, that's good. Win. Yes, we're going to have a new Twitter as well, which I haven't set up yet at the time of recording because Beck has lost the password and we can't get back in. So we'll have a new Twitter, which we'll have that soon. And you can also find our Facebook group too, where we'll be previewing bits and bobs and sharing things that are exclusive, hopefully. So we'll be back next time with another BBC book. This time it's the brilliant Demontage by the eternally excellent Justin Richards. And also, I'd like to say a huge thanks to James Hadwin Bennett for his help with all of the DWM content that you've heard today, and of course, in the coming episodes. So until next time, I've been Kenny Smith.
And I was Matt Michael.
Bye.